This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Spanning the centuries this hour, we'll see how Texas is revisiting some century-old oil boom politics. And it's the first bona fide trial of the century in South Africa for accused murderer and celebrity athlete Oscar Pistorius. But we begin with the centuries-old echoes of nationalism emerging with historic intensity in Ukraine and Russia. Parts of Ukraine are under occupation by pro-Russian troops today. There has been an ultimatum issued to Ukraine by the Russian Navy Command to surrender its forces in Crimea. To some, maybe most, in Russia, Ukraine is still a part of Russia. Ukraine's chief naval officer seems to have taken that view by defecting over the weekend to Russia, raising tensions further. He is now facing treason charges in Kiev. The fledgling Ukrainian leadership in Kiev, meanwhile, has called on the West, including NATO, to rally against a Russian invasion. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is headed to Ukraine. Russia's foreign ministry, meanwhile, has warned the U.S. to stay out of this crisis, calling warnings from Secretary Kerry and President Obama unacceptable threats and Cold War rhetoric. The West, the Moscow statement says, is ignoring militant anti-Russian and anti-Semitic extremists among the Ukrainian opposition who Moscow believes were behind the coup in Kiev. British Foreign Secretary William Hague says this crisis could easily ripple across Europe economically and in waves of refugees with an intensity not seen since the wars in the Balkans.
It's difficult to rank these things. But it is certainly the biggest crisis in Europe in the 21st century.
For a look at the rising tensions in Crimea, we go first to Natalia Antolava in the regional capital, Simferopol. Natalia, welcome.
Thank you very much.
There's a Russian majority in Crimea, and that makes it unique in all the territories in Ukraine. What's the feeling like today as everyone has to ask themselves, am I Russian or am I Ukrainian?
Extremely tense, I would say. I've been struck for the last few days by how fragile the balance, the ethnic balance here is. 60% of Crimea are Russian, as you said, but then there are other groups as well. There is an indigenous group here. They're Crimean Tatars. They're Muslims. They are only about 15% of the population, but because they're indigenous, they are very important. They're very vocal. They're also Ukrainians, of course, and the divisions amongst them are quite extraordinary. And they've deepened by the presence of the Russian troops. Yesterday, I was at the demonstration of the pro-Russian Putin supporters, basically those who welcome the presence of the troops, those who say they want them here. And, at that demonstration, the argument broke out among a couple of people saying, you know, we don't want Tatars here, one of them was saying. The other one was screaming about how bad the Ukrainians have been to the Russians. There are people who are very worried that the presence of Russian troops will upset this very delicate ethnic balance here. And you can really feel that tension already.
And call it ethnic balance or call it something that Joe Stalin tried to put to rest in the 20th century, all of these competing ethnicities within Russia, they were moved around, they were suppressed, and all of this seems to be erupting at once in Crimea.
Absolutely. And, people here are saying that they're going to be the victims of the of that big game that is being played out here in Crimea. And I think people realize very clearly that unless they manage to not to allow the outsiders to basically provoke them against each other, this is going to end very, very badly. I mean, you know, they're constant, this kind of snippets of tension at the gas station. Yesterday, we stopped to fill up the car, and this man runs into the gas station, basically screaming on the phone, what am I going to do with my family? How am I going to move my mother? She's in a wheelchair. And he was a Tatar. He says that he's heard that, the Russian neighbors are sort of turning against them. There are all sorts of dynamics that are playing out here, and people are saying, many people are saying, including some ethnic Russians I have spoken to, that because of the presence of the Russian troops, all of this has really amplified.
Is there anyone in Crimea who is rising above this, who's advocating to keep outsiders from escalating this tension so that, as you say, the people in Crimea don't become the victims of a wider conflict? Any character to confront Vladimir Putin or to address the West?
I wouldn't say that there is one person in particular, but certainly a lot of people who are I have been speaking to are very aware of how fragile the situation is. And, you know, people are organizing themselves. For example, I went to several neighborhoods where people are trying to do joint patrols where the neighbors get together. You know, what makes the situation even worse, even more complicated. And this has happened in all of the post-Soviet conflicts in Georgia, in everywhere else in the Caucasus. Normally, once the Russian regular army comes in, they're followed by the irregular fighters, the mercenaries, who are often Cossacks. Now, I have not seen any of them, but everybody that I've spoken to, at least all the Tatars and all the Ukrainians that I have spoken to, say that the Cossacks are already coming in, and they're coming in to stir up the tensions. So there is a very keen awareness of the fact that, you know, this could be huge. If neighbors turn against each other, then, you know, this is going to be a bloodbath. And I think people are trying their best not to allow this to happen and not to allow any provocation. And those night patrols are one of the examples. But it's so tense here, and everyone is on such an edge that it will take very, very little for this to get out of control.
Well, with an ultimatum on the table and a 60% Russian majority in Crimea, do the Tatars and the Ukrainians have any choice but to surrender?
I don't think surrendering will be an option. I mean, for the Tatars and the Ukrainians, surrendering isn't even on the table. The other question is, what will the Ukrainian army do? And the latest that we're hearing right now is that, you know, for the last 48 hours, the Russian military, although they're still, you know, in unmarked uniforms, but they are definitely Russian military, have been taking over the various military bases around Crimea. And in some of them, some of these bases, there have been standoffs. For example, I went to a base earlier today where the standoff started yesterday. The base is completely surrounded by the Russian troops, but the Ukrainians are inside, not letting them in. So now the latest that we've heard is that the Russians have given Ukrainians an ultimatum telling them that unless they surrender those bases in the next, I believe, 24 hours, they said, that they will be taken over. Now, that is also quite serious. But in that case, you know, probably the Ukrainian army will surrender, because, again, not allowing Russians into those bases will end up in bloodshed.
Reporting from a very tense situation, Natalia Antilava from Crimea. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Inching closer to a military confrontation between Ukraine and Russia. Today, some analysts have concluded that Vladimir Putin has effectively accomplished a takeover of the Crimean territory without firing a shot. That's what former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Stephen Pfeiffer told us. He's currently a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Well, I think the situation is that the Russian military, effectively in violation of Russia's commitment to Ukraine's territorial integrity, has taken over the peninsula of Crimea. The question now is, will the Russians halt military actions at this point, or will there be a broader military intervention into eastern Ukraine? I think the latter would be a big mistake. While the Ukrainians have shown great restraint, Ukrainian military forces in Crimea have stayed on their bases. I think a wider intervention in eastern Ukraine would lead the Ukrainian army to fight.
Is this a replay, do you think, of the dispute between Georgia and Russia just some years ago, back in 2008?
Well, it looks something like that story. But in this case, though, there was, as far as anyone in the West saw, no threat to ethnic Russians in Crimea. There was no threat to the Russian military installations in Crimea that they have by treaty with Ukraine. A good portion of the Russian Black Sea Fleet is based there. And it looks like this was a manufactured crisis. In fact, there were a series of things that looked as if they were designed to provoke a Ukrainian military response in Crimea. And then when the Ukrainians did not respond, the Russians just went in on their own.
And there are diplomats in Western Europe saying this is the biggest crisis for Europe in the last 20 or 30 years. Do you share that view?
I think this is a huge crisis for Europe, and it's a case where Russia has basically torn up the rule book. And I would guess about a week ago, there was a perception that Russia was not happy with the turn of events in Kyiv and might take steps to destabilize the new Ukraine government. But pretty much all analysts expected the Russians would do something in the economic sphere, raise the price of gas, block Ukrainian imports. I think people were caught off guard by the fact that Mr. Putin leaped over those and went right for this military intervention in Crimea.
As a former ambassador to Ukraine from 1998 to 2000, you're probably well aware of the Russian name for Ukraine, right?
Very much so. Crimea is the only area in Ukraine where ethnic Russians constitute a majority of the population. It's about 60%. There's always been this special relationship. Crimea actually was part of Russia until 1954, when Nikita Khrushchev made a decision to transfer it from the Russian Federation to the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. But when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, all agreed that you would recognize the states in their current borders, and the Russians at that time recognized Crimea fully as part of Ukraine.
Even though they still refer to Ukraine informally as Little Russia.
That's true. It's one of those things. I remember a conversation I had with a very good, very senior Russian diplomat back in the 1990s. And his comment was, you know, when it comes to Crimea up here, and he points at his head, I understand it's an independent country. He goes down here and he points at his heart. It's going to take a little bit longer. And I think with Vladimir Putin, you have somebody who's not looking at Ukraine in those terms. You're looking at somebody who really does want to extend Russian influence in the post-Soviet space and is now showing that he's resorting to means that people did not expect to push that ambition.
So perhaps we are at the ultimate red line here. If there is a move beyond Crimea, beyond this level of occupation, and I use the word guardedly, of territory inside Ukraine, Vladimir Putin suddenly becomes the Milosevic of a greater Russia policy in the same way that Slobodan Milosevic was the greater Serbia architect of the 1990s.
First of all, let me just say, you know, your term occupation, I mean, what you're now seeing in Crimea is a military occupation of the peninsula by Russian forces. There's no doubt about it. But if Mr. Putin goes beyond that, there are big risks for Russia. A Russian military intervention in eastern Ukraine would lead to a situation where some Ukrainian military units would fight. There would be Ukrainian nationalists from western Ukraine who I believe would head east and conduct basically a guerrilla war. It could be very nasty for Russia. And my hope is that the Russian military understands this and is telling Mr. Putin, this is not something we want to get into. In the meantime, though, there are other costs for Russia. When the Russian stock market opened up today, the main index fell by 10% and the ruble's at an all-time low. There's a lot of concern in Russia, I think, about what's going on between Russia and Ukraine right now.
He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, Stephen Pieper's former ambassador to Ukraine from the United States from 1998 to 2000. Ambassador, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
A new energy boom in Texas, a state whose economy, culture, and politics have been defined by cattle and fossil fuel booms and busts, is making it tough in the wide open spaces for some residents of that state. Besides being home to some of the largest oil deposits on Earth, Texas has rich shale deposits that, with new drilling technology, can be exploited for oil and especially natural gas. The 400-mile Eagle Ford shale formations in East Texas lie beneath land on which 1.1 million people live. And it's one of the most active drilling sites in America today. Advanced fracking techniques to break up the layers of shale and snake-like drills that can bore in nearly any direction deep underground have opened Eagle Ford. Since 2008, the energy industry has drilled more than 7,000 oil and gas wells in the area, and another 5,500 have been approved by state regulators. The aggressive green light for this drilling and fracking is part of the historic Texas-style boom mentality, with some potential very Texas-sized environmental consequences. Inside Climate News conducted an investigation into air quality around Eagle Ford and the state of regulation and oversight over this latest energy bonanza. We spoke with Inside Climate News reporter Lisa Song.
It's a very rural part of Texas a lot of people don't know about, and what we found was pretty shocking. For example, nearly one in four Texas state legislatures or their spouses have a direct financial interest in the Eagle Ford shale.
Forget the lawmakers. I mean, if you just look at the Texas Railway Commission that regulates this fracking, the three Perry appointed, Governor Perry appointed commissioners collectively got something like $20 million from the industry in contributions in one way or another?
Well, there's actually two regulatory agencies in Texas with this industry. There's the Texas Railroad Commission, which has nothing to do with railroads, but they control drilling permits for oil and gas. And when you're looking at the air pollution part, which is what we focused on, that's controlled by a separate agency called the TCEQ, or Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. And those commissioners are appointed by Governor Perry. And for the Railroad Commission, their commissioners are actually elected officials, but they do receive a lot of contributions from the very industry that they are regulating.
All right. So in a situation where there seems to be a profound, deep sympathy for industry and energy development in the state of Texas, the story of Mary Alice Longoria seems particularly sad. I mean, describe the deterioration in her quality of life and why she is apparently not motivated to take her case anywhere to get sort of recompense from her government.
Well, Mary Alice Longoria is an X-ray technician, and she lives in Karnes County, which is basically at the heart of the drilling in the Eagle Ford. And she lives with her grandson, and she lives with her husband. And for a long time, they lived in a very calm and peaceful part of the county. And when the drilling came, her life was totally disrupted by the flares and the lights and the noise. And now she's afraid to let her grandson play outside because she's afraid the fumes will affect his health. And what she told us was that she never thought to complain because she didn't think it would do any good.
Is Longoria right? I mean, the industrial tax base in Karnes County has grown from $217 million back in 2008, you report, to $6.2 billion in 2013. It's a bonanza in the county.
What is very interesting is when you go to Karnes County, it does not look like a place that has billions of dollars of investment in the community. There are still some very poor parts of town, places that look rather run down, and some people who have benefited greatly because they have sold their mineral rights and have, you know, for the first time, financial security. And there are others who have not benefited from the boom financially at all. And for people like Longoria, all they can see and feel are the adverse impacts of the boom in terms of the health and the odors, you know, the things that they can smell.
What's in the air here, and how is it a particularly complicated health risk if you add up all the different kinds of things that people could be breathing as a result of this fracking?
There are many, many dozens or even hundreds of chemicals that are emitted at various stages. And you have things like hydrogen sulfide, which is a deadly gas when it's released in enough quantities. That is mostly a danger for workers. And then you have things like benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene. These are toxic gases that can lead to cancer if people are exposed for long enough. We found nearly 300 complaints from local residents in the Eagle Ford since 2010. It's people calling the TCEQ and saying, you know, I'm having nosebleeds, I have headaches, there's a chemical smell in the air, my kids are sick, I think it's being caused by this industry. And to really try and see, is it those gases that are causing these symptoms, we need the scientific studies to figure that out. And that is what we don't have right now.
We also don't appear to have much in the way of actual oversight in Texas. There's something called permit by rule, where polluters in certain categories are just permitted to do whatever they want. And even the big players, when they violate, aren't necessarily fined. Tell me the story of Mike and Myra Cerny.
What happened with them was, you know, they live within a couple miles of many, many wells and processing and production facilities. And one of the facilities called Sugarhorn Central, the regulators actually had documented problems at that plant. There were emission events where they were venting, you know, thousands of pounds of toxic gases when they were not supposed to. But in the end, the company was not fined.
And the residents weren't warned.
Right. And the residents had no warning. For the Sugarhorn plant and actually a different plant nearby, there were a couple instances when the regulators were on site doing an inspection. And they write in the report that, you know, the pieces of equipment was emitting so many gases that it was dangerous. And the regulators actually left the scene to prevent exposure. But, you know, they didn't warn the residents that something like this was happening near their homes.
What's the takeaway, do you think, from all this investigation? Is this a Texas story that people who are near drilling sites around the country where natural gas is increasingly obtained through fracking is something they don't have to worry about? Or is air pollution as opposed to water pollution, which we think much more about, maybe the real issue?
I think what's happening in Texas could have an impact on what's happening in other states. You know, Texas could be a sort of cautionary tale for states like New York or California that are looking at how to regulate fracking and if they allow it in their states.
Lisa Song, a reporter for Inside Climate News. Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
From big power politics to big data politics in the United States, it seems the Affordable Care Act is something of a political animal. Places sympathetic to the law politically seem to be getting a better deal as the law rolls out, even for all its problems. But if the intention was to make it easiest for the people with the least money to afford health insurance, that, according to the latest data, is not happening. Dante Chinney is the director of the American Communities Project at American University and a familiar voice on this program. He's made a map by numbers that shows how much it costs for insurance under the ACA, county by county.
What we're seeing in the numbers is that it really does vary by where you live, but it's not the correlation that one might expect. You might expect that if you lived in a wealthier area that you would pay a bit more for insurance because you're basically the cost of living is higher, you get paid more, so that's the way things work. The problem is that's not the way the private insurance system works. You get to more rural communities, you have a smaller number of providers. Oftentimes you have older populations. So the pool that you're put in with in those places, the premiums tend to be higher and you make less money. So actually it is often more expensive to buy insurance if you live in a rural locale, an older locale, than it is if you live in a big city where you make more money and you end up paying less for insurance.
So the Affordable Care Act goes into a situation that is already full of disparities. Part of the intent was to try to level things out, but it sounds like that really hasn't happened, at least so far.
No. In fact, the problem is the old system was built on all these disparities. There are just inherent differences in the number of people who offer policies in different places and what those policies look like. And then what you did with the ACA is it said, well, we don't want to disrupt the system too much, so we're just going to take this law and place it on top of something that already exists. And the problem is now what you're doing is you're forcing people in places to buy insurance under this old system that was full of these disparities. And it's going to create some problems. I mean, look, we're still early, right? We're very early in the rollout of this law ultimately and what it's going to mean. But when you look at these numbers now, the disparities are, they're not what you'd want to see, right? So in the communities we call the African-American South, these are large African-American populations, primarily in the South, sometimes popping up elsewhere. The lowest premium you would pay for a silver plan, which is like a middle range plan for
right.
a 21-year-old, you're paying $231 a month.
Right.
The average median household income in those places is only $35,000 a year. If you go for that same plan or the same kind of plan to a big city,
where the average median household income is something like $61,000.
Exactly. If you go to a big city, it's $55,000, but still, it's much higher. You're talking $20,000 higher. They're paying less. They're paying $185 a month for that same, theoretically, roughly the same plan, the silver plan. That's a real problem.
There are some real, disparities here, which show that some communities, the ACA, might be an actual significant burden. And I'm thinking of some of the Native American communities you looked at.
Those Native American communities, they had the highest average, lowest premium, $234 a month is what they're talking about paying. And the average median household income in those places is $40,000. But look, in many of those counties, it's much, much lower. And, the problem with a lot of those places in those communities is a lot of people don't have insurance. There are much higher rates of obesity, much higher body mass index on average, problems with alcoholism a lot of times in these communities. That's why the rates are so much higher to begin with. And now the people in those communities are being forced to buy insurance. I mean, it's a really interesting kind of quandary.
Here's this law that's trying to have an impact on public health in places that need it most. And you seem to be concluding here that it's ending up helping the most, the people who need it the least.
I don't know if I'd go so far as to say need it the least, but the thing that's curious is these places that are kind of more predisposed maybe to like the ACA in the first place are the ones who are going to do the best under this. And when you look at these premiums, and the places that are kind of more predisposed to dislike the ACA, particularly when you get out to counties we call working class country, evangelical hubs, they're already predisposed to dislike the plan once they start paying premiums under this.
Dante Cheney is director of the American Communities Project at American University. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
This week, we return to our friends at Retro Report, who are taking a look back at a disaster in the summer of 2007 in Minneapolis.
It's obvious there were troubling safety questions about this bridge years before the collapse.
Annual inspections had noted assorted cracks, corrosion, and fatigue.
So why was the state of Minnesota, all the way up to the governor's office, telling us this bridge was safe?
A disaster on a bridge with no name that carried 140,000 vehicles per day, the I-35W bridge over the Mississippi River in Minneapolis, collapsed without warning one hot Wednesday afternoon, killing 13 people. That bridge has been replaced, but if the early warning system for America's infrastructure was a collapse back in 2007, how are we doing today? Drew Megraton is here, Retro Report producer. Welcome, Drew.
Welcome. Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about the lessons. I mean, really in 2007, there were warning signs, but people didn't know about them. And really only action was taken after 13 people died. That was the warning system.
That's right. I mean, the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, did determine that it was a 40-year-old design flaw, which is what actually brought the bridge down. So a lot of the corrosion and fatigue wasn't necessarily relevant to the collapse from an engineering standpoint. But the fact is that this bridge was in bad shape before the collapse and wasn't getting the attention that it deserved.
And in typical Retro Report hindsight, Tom Johnson is the author of the report into the I-35 collapse for the Minnesota legislature. Let's listen to his voice, which comes from your report.
There's a tension between spending money for new roads or new interchanges or putting money into the repair of a bridge. That bridge was standing yesterday, standing today. Why won't it be standing tomorrow? The lesson is that you've got to maintain bridges.
The principle there, bridge was standing yesterday, it'll be standing tomorrow, it's standing today. There's no incentive to really make these investments in infrastructure upgrade. How big is the threat, do you think, around the country?
Well, things have gotten a lot better since the collapse, but they have a long way to go. And repairing some of these bridges that are major arteries in major cities is a huge expense and a huge task. You have to close bridges down, divert traffic. It costs a lot of money. And that's what Minnesota was faced at with prior to the collapse. They had several of these type of bridges.
And in a sense, the anonymity of this bridge was one of the things that concealed its shortcomings. And there are all kinds of anonymous bridges all over the United States.
That's right. And many of the most deteriorated and vulnerable are the ones that are overpasses and aren't very majestic.
The voice we heard there in the introduction is Barry LePatner, who's a construction attorney. We actually spoke earlier this hour about his concern that cracks in bridges aren't viewed the same way as cracks in aircraft, for instance. Here's his general view of the situation right now, also from your report.
There is no safety net. They're all vulnerable. And we should be immediately finding the funds to fix those bridges and give them greater structural integrity because they don't have any right now.
Now, is this an attorney looking for plaintiffs or really a serious indictment of America's infrastructure?
Well, he's just pointing out the fact that what links the 35W and a couple other collapses, most recently the I-5 collapse north of Seattle last year, is that these bridges are fracture critical, meaning they're designed with no redundancy in place. So if something out of the ordinary happens, there is a risk that they could fall down. There's no backup system. So he's making the point that that's where we should look for first in terms of where to put our money, because those pose a unique risk to the traveling public.
In aviation, there's triple redundancy in aviation products. On bridges, zero redundancy.
Yet they carry 140,000 cars a day in Minneapolis and probably way more in other cities.
Right. Well, certainly the redundancy is not at the level of aviation, and many policymakers have asked that question, why is there a cultural difference, if you will?
And no federal initiative to make that regulation the law of the land. Drew, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Drew McGrotten is producer for Retro Report, working with our partners at The New York Times. You can watch his full report at thetakeaway.org. The Sound of the Russian Soul. Sergei Rachmaninoff and Dmitri Shostakovich, two very different voices of that Russian soul, one romantic and heroic, one full of turmoil and conflict. These musical voices reflect the real ambiguities in the Russian identity even today. Take geography. What has been understood historically as the territory of Russia, in a very real sense, is not Russian at all. Most of the landmass is actually Siberia to the east, an amalgam of tribes and ethnicities reshuffled and variously exterminated down through the centuries. In the West, Russia is an amalgam of European, Turkic identities and the peoples of the Caucasus and Baltics. Ukraine lies at the very center of this swirl of cultures, even though its name means on the edge. Russians have traditionally called it Malorussia, Little Russia. Russia's national identity condensed out of the European turmoil that exploded from the French Revolution in the late 1700s. But Russia was late to find its national identity and, in a sense, is still looking for it. In many ways, the voice that may speak loudest about this search for identity on the part of both Russia and Ukraine is not protesters or the government. It is the literary voice of Russia. Anne Lounsbury, chair of Russian and Slavic Studies at New York University, joins us. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
What do we learn? What do we hear in voices of Nikolai Gogol, for instance, who coined the phrase Russian soul, and Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, when we think about these different identities of Ukraine and Russia?
I think that what we learn from looking at Gogol, and I think he is the place we would look to think about this question, is we learn about the uncomfortable hybridity of Russian identity and Ukrainian identity as well. And it's something that's not so easy to acknowledge, particularly once romantic nationalism kicks in the 19th century. But in fact, Russian national identity has been and arguably still is largely an imperial identity. One scholar of Russian history, Jeffrey Hosking, said that Britain had an empire. Russia is an empire.
Hmm. And when we think about Gogol, he is a Ukrainian by birth, even though In Dead Souls, his most famous book, is a parody, an extraordinary parody of the characters inside Russia at all levels of class and bureaucracy and villages, cities. In a way, he's a detached looker at Russia, almost as a satirist.
Yes, exactly. And some people attribute his satiric gaze to his Ukrainian origins. And in fact, when he first began publishing in the 1830s, some reviewers thought that his sort of caustic take on Russia had to do with his Ukrainian origins. He was born in Ukraine in Poltava. His home language was Ukrainian. His last name actually was not just Gogol, it was Gogol Yanovsky, which Yanovsky is a Polish surname, and that points to the family's, you know, further mixed origins.
And the fact that the Polish Empire ruled Ukraine for much of the, I guess, 13th and 14th centuries.
Exactly, exactly. And but Gogol did what many educated elites did at that time, and that is, without in any way disavowing his Ukrainianness, he identified with the imperial center, with high Russian culture that was located in Petersburg, in order to make a career. In his case, it was a literary career, and he went to Petersburg and promptly made it big. It was a literary career in his case, but this is what Ukrainian elites often did in many spheres. So you ended up with an educated stratum of the populace who truly did have mixed identity. And it's not that they had betrayed their, you know, sacred origins in some way. It's that they were making it in the world.
What about Dostoevsky and Tolstoy? Do they view Ukraine as part of Russia? Do they have a notion of a greater Russian identity in their literature?
Dostoevsky was a Russian nationalist, and he certainly would have seen Ukrainians as a subset of Russians, which was a fairly typical way for Russian nationalists by the second half of the 19th century to see Ukrainians. Tolstoy, it was probably more complicated because Tolstoy was in no way identified with the Russian state or with the Russian Empire, and he tended to see things more in local terms. I think with his essentially anthropological gaze, Tolstoy would have seen Ukrainians as their own thing, but he didn't pay much attention to Ukrainians.
What about the indigenous Ukrainian poets, the voices like Ivan Franko and people who are revered by Ukrainians but not really well known anywhere else?
Yes. I mean, one thing I should make clear is that I am a scholar of Russian literature, and so the voice that you're hearing is the voice of someone who's interested in people who write in Russian about Ukraine. If you had a scholar of Ukrainian literature here, you would get a different story. And one of the things you would hear would be the way that Russian imperial power tried to restrict the use of Ukrainian language, certainly in print, tried to confine it essentially to being a kind of peasant folk language. And it was in the early decades of the 19th century that the language was in effect reclaimed and shaped as a modern literary language by people like Shevchenko. Gogol, again, is the flashpoint. He's sort of the battleground. So you get ongoing fights even today between sort of the Russian side and the Ukrainian side about who owns Gogol. You spell his name differently depending on which side you're on. You say his name differently. And you see him on both sides as a patriot, but for a different entity.
And yet when Khrushchev in the 50s declared that Crimea was a part of Ukraine and
yes,
not a part of Russia, it was seen then in the Soviet context as just a technicality. This is like a
yes,
completely settled issue. Now it's exploded again.
Yes.
Why?
I think that it's somewhat difficult to answer that question through the lens of classic Russian literature, but I would say that what happened is an identity that was sort of comfortably hybrid at certain points is not allowed to be comfortably hybrid at other points. What Ukraine actually is a mixed country, people speaking different languages and sort of identifying with different political entities. And this is a moment when that is not acceptable. And I think that you have people on both sides, the same groups of people who fought over Gogol are still there sort of duking it out about what their identity is.
A melting pot on a boil.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think it's another one of those sort of central and southern European places that probably shouldn't be understood strictly in terms of European romantic nationalism.
Anne Lounsbery is chair of Russian and Slavic Studies at New York University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Does the West and the United States have a role to play in this history being rewritten in Ukraine, Crimea, and Russia? What should the U.S. do, if anything? Barbara on Facebook, there need to be sanctions, and lots of them. Jane in Nevada, this sounds like something to be handled between Russia and Ukraine. What would you say? Facebook.com/TheTakeaway or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. It's global courtroom theater here at the end of the hour with the credibility of a criminal justice system, teams of high-profile lawyers, and the fate of a celebrity athlete all on the line and all in front of television cameras. The venue is not Los Angeles, the athlete is not O.J. Simpson, and the lawyers in this trial do not have their own TV shows yet. The murder trial of Olympic runner Oscar Pistorius begins today with multiple narratives. The South African judiciary is itself under scrutiny on the world stage. Defendant Pistorius is the double amputee runner who made history in the Paralympic Games and the London Olympics, accused of murdering his TV star and fashion model girlfriend Reva Steenkamp last year. Steenkamp was shot and killed in Pistorius's luxury home. The prosecution says it was premeditated murder. Pistorius, who has pleaded not guilty, says it was mistaken identity. He thought Steenkamp was an intruder. The South African judiciary is on TV for the first time in a trial which is one of the first of its kind in the global internet social media era. We reached out to Anders Kelto, Africa correspondent for PRI's The World in Cape Town, and BBC South African correspondent Nomsa Maseko reporting from right outside the Pistorius courtroom in Pretoria.
Well, as you quite rightly say, it is a global trial, but unfortunately the weather is not playing along. It's quite a dull and grey and rainy day here in Pretoria, in fact all over South Africa. But what we are seeing inside the courtroom is quite heated. The first witness has already testified, and before then Mr. Pistorius was asked to plead, and in which he pleaded not guilty to all four charges that he faces, including the murder of his girlfriend and the illegal possession of ammunition. So he's pleaded not guilty to those charges, and already the first witness, who says she heard terrified screams of a woman who was scared, who was calling for help on the night of the shooting, and then followed by gunshots. That is what she said, that she told the court that she heard. But as I speak to you now, the lawyer representing Oscar Pistorius is already tearing into the evidence that in chief that the witness has given, saying that she's not sure of what she heard, and she should therefore tell the truth.
Anders Kelto, there are some police misconduct issues that will certainly play very prominently in this trial, and there's been significant coverage of those. Can you lay those out for us?
Well, the lead investigator on the case initially was removed from the case because he admitted to basically having botched things. He didn't collect evidence correctly. And he himself, it was later revealed, was awaiting his own trial for, I believe, 9 counts of manslaughter or attempted murder. He essentially allegedly fired a gun at a taxi filled with people that was speeding away from him when he was working as a police officer one day. So in part because of those charges and in part because of his handling of the case, he stepped down, and his bad work is now being held against the prosecuting team.
And will be a significant part of the defense. Anders Kelto, do people in South Africa believe that this trial is, in a sense, a judgment or an examination of the criminal justice system for the world in South Africa post-apartheid?
Some people are seeing it that way, because South Africa, as you know, is sometimes seen as not having an effective justice system. The claim that I hear a lot is that it's easy on the rich and hard on the poor and vulnerable, and this will sort of put that theory to the test. But I think it's not just an assessment of the justice system. I think there's a moral to the story here that South Africans are trying to figure out. It's partly about the justice system, but it's also about what does this say about South African society? I mean, what does this say about violence towards women, which is an incredibly big problem here? What does this say about fear of crime? I mean, if Oscar Pistorius' story is true, and he was scared that there was an intruder who had somehow managed to get into his heavily fortified home and was attacking him, is that a reflection of a sense of paranoia among the middle and upper classes here? Or is this a story about gun control? If he indeed shot her accidentally, one could make the argument that if he hadn't had a gun and hadn't been so quick to pull the trigger, that this tragedy would have been avoided. So I think South Africans are just trying to figure out how to make sense of this, or what lessons to draw from it.
Nomsa Maseko, let's go over some of those issues that Anders Kelto raised. Do you think the trial will explore the other narrative in this case, that is, Pistorius' perceived vulnerability, being a double amputee, a disabled individual in a luxury housing complex in a country where there is a serious issue of tolerance of violence against women? Will all that play out on the stand?
It is likely to play out on the stand. I mean, Mr. Pistorius already says that he feared that there was an intruder in his house, and that is why he fired 4 shots at close range towards the bathroom door, the toilet door, where he later then discovered that his girlfriend, Riva Steenkamp, was actually there. But to go back to what your guest also said there about the police messing up the case, already Oscar Pistorius's defense lawyer says the fact that the police have contaminated, disturbed, and tempered with the crime scene is a problem. And of course, we do know that the bathroom door, this toilet door in which Oscar Pistorius shot at, was actually removed from the scene itself and is sitting at a police station, because the police were saying that they're scared that somebody might actually tamper with the evidence, and they've already done so themselves.
Do you believe, no matter what the verdict, this will be a divided result for the people of South Africa, that there are people who believe there's no way he'll get a fair trial, and there are other people who believe there's no way he could be convicted because he's rich?
Well, you know, a lot of people seem to confuse the issues here between class and race. And Pistorius's case has nothing to do with race, as far as I can see. People here are likely to say that if he gets off, he would have gotten off because of his race, because of his skin color. How many black people actually get convicted for such cases without actually thinking about class? And some people are also saying that money can buy him anything. He's got the best lawyer money can buy. Who is one of the top lawyers in this country, but of course he's also up against a top prosecutor in this country, and the judge herself is no you know, little or small town kind of player. In one of the recent cases in which she was the presiding judge, she sentenced a former police officer to life imprisonment for having shot and killed his ex-wife. We've also seen her sentencing an armed robber to more than 200 years in prison. So, I mean, it's three people that are on top of their game and are thorough when it comes to doing their job.
Well, the table's certainly set for an extraordinary global courtroom drama. Nomsa Maseko, BBC South Africa correspondent, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Anders Kelto, Africa correspondent for PRI's The World, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John.
So tomorrow on the program, housing and the tarnished American dream since the 2008 recession. Are the homes in your neighborhood assets or liabilities? Boom or bust on the home front? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can tweet us at The Takeaway.
My name is Pam from Queens, and as far as house being a burden or not, right now it's more of a burden. It's 90 years old. It's falling apart little by little. At this point, I'd rather sell it, take the money and run.
Or from Winter Park, Florida, my house has rebounded from the housing crisis and is worth twice what we paid for it 10 years ago. The neighborhood is experiencing a boom, listed as one of the hottest places to live in Central Florida. I'm thinking asset. Boom time in Florida and Texas, not so much in Queens. Tell us about where you live. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.